U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at AlibabaPowersBusinesses.com.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
The awful killing of 19 children and two teachers at Robb Elementary School in Uvalde, Texas, has shocked the country. As we learn more details about Salvador Ramos, the 18-year-old shooter, and his attack on Tuesday, the public debate over the killings and how to stop mass shootings in the future is also in full force. Will any useful reforms come out of this tragedy? Welcome. I'm Paul Gigot, here with my colleagues Kyle Peterson and Kate Batchelder-Odell. Welcome to you both. We're learning more about Salvador Ramos and his attack. In many ways, a familiar profile of a mass shooter, a young male at an age when mental health problems often surface, 18, a loner bullied as a young man because of a speech impediment, according to reporting that's now emerging, dysfunctional family life. Fought with his mother, who reportedly had a drug problem. Fought with his grandmother, who he shot in the face, apparently, before he headed to the school to do his destruction. Kate, any surprises? I mean, anything that strikes you about Ramos and his background? And I would note, it's similar, not the same in all respects, but similar to so many other mass shooters in recent years.
Yes, Paul. I mean, I think it's important to note first that the causes here are many, and we can't distill this to a single narrative, but I do think discussing some of the features of his background that you just described are really important here in asking how this young man got to the margins of society with so little notice or ability to flag for either, before he turned 18, a child welfare bureaucracy or law enforcement. I mean, there are some questions here about, like you said, his really dark family life that we don't have answers to, such as what is his juvenile record? Had the cops interacted with his family? He appears to have, according to some reporting, stopped attending school at some point and wasn't set to graduate. What was the school aware of about what was going on in his home life and his mental state? These are, Paul, some questions I think we really need to get some answers to as we start to get a fact pattern and what exactly happened here, which I think should be the starting point in informing some of the political discussion. But I do think it's worth noting that, to your point, there have been some common features of the people who commit these awful crimes. And we're seeing here maybe an insufficient response from these social safety net programs that are supposed to exist to keep people from getting so far onto the margins of society.
Well, those programs, Kate, are very good at writing checks. They can do transfer payments. You can get money for any number of things, childcare subsidies, employment checks if you've lost your job, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. But the social service bureaucracy just isn't there to mold character or to do much, even when it comes to children at risk. I mean, they can take them out of troubled homes, but boy, they have a hard time diagnosing larger problems.
Right, Paul. And so we don't know here what efforts were taken to get this young man out of this home, or if any were taken. To your point about basically interactions with the welfare state tend to be more focused on check writing exercises. And one thing we see here is, despite we don't know the socioeconomic situation of the family exactly, but we do know he was playing video games. We do have evidence he had a smartphone and was using it regularly. He appears to have had a job at a Wendy's for a while. It doesn't seem as though it was whatever happened here was motivated by material deprivation so much as really deep social dysfunction. The tragedy is compounded by the fact that there may have been several years to intervene in this case beforehand. So I think that's why figuring out to what extent the school and social services and other institutions were involved is just so essential.
Kyle, he was confronted, we are learning, by a security guard at the school, but overwhelmed that guard to get into the school. He managed to barricade himself in a classroom and held off police who arrived on the scene for something like more than a half hour until the Border Patrol agents with special tactical weapons training arrived and charged the room and ended up killing him, although not before two of them were hurt themselves, one by a shot and another apparently by shrapnel. We do have to learn more, I think, about the details and timeline of this, because that would give us some insight into just how effective it is to have a security guard at a school, what other requirements may be needed. I mean, there have been suggestions that every school needs a security guard, but here they had one and apparently didn't help.
Yeah, and I think there are a lot more details to be learned yet. There's some reporting that the shooter was inside the building long enough that parents who had the first alert that something was going on showed up and were urging the police to go in. And I don't know, I mean, maybe we'll learn whether that's true or how true that was or more details about that situation. But I think it also raises questions about whether police have the tools that they need to deal with these kinds of situations. There's been sort of a movement in recent years against what is called the militarization of police. There are federal programs where excess gear from the federal government gets sent to police departments around the nation. And there have been opponents of that. And the idea that we need to get back to the local guy with a nightstick walking the beat. And I understand that argument. On the other hand, what the police say in response to that is there are shooters like this that have access to pretty serious weaponry and they can buy, you know, armored plates or armored vests. And so we need the tools to respond to that. And especially in a place like this, this is not a big city. It's a town, I think, of something like 15,000 people. And so I think there will also be questions about what the police department was waiting for there and whether they had the materials that they thought they needed to go in.
Well, I believe I've read reports that two police officers were wounded in attempting to confront the killer. And storming I'm no expert on this, but storming somebody who is barricaded in any kind of confined space where he is able to shoot and also protected by body armor and so on with high-powered weapons, it's a very dangerous circumstance, particularly if you still think that there are hostages there or wounded young children, which there were, children who may not have been shot yet. It's just very difficult for people without tactical training, even police officers, to go in, Kate.
Yes, we're supposed to get a more detailed timeline assembled on Thursday afternoon from Texas law enforcement officials. And I think looking at that timeline will be both instructive and hopefully helpful in understanding exactly what happened here and how to prevent it from happening again. There are just competing accounts. To your point, I don't think these can be stopped merely with one person in the school with a gun if someone shows up with such heavy weaponry. But there are genuine questions about the parents that are starting to talk to the press that they were outside and they wanted the police to act faster. So we need to hear from the police about what they were waiting for, whether this was a training issue, whether this was an equipment issue, whether, you know, it does appear that two cops immediately tried to go in and were shot themselves and they had to wait or did wait for this tactical border unit to arrive. But tactical border units with such exquisite training are seldom on hand for responding to these kinds of events. So we need to understand exactly what actions the cops took and when, and to what extent that influenced the shooter's ability to continue his horrible massacre. The question is whether that 40 minutes really changed the death toll, and I don't think we have answers to that at this point, and I think we'll need to get a much fuller timeline. But we should be slowed here to draw firm conclusions in the absence of that information, and given how much competing information there seems to be here about the exact exchanges between the gunman and the police.
Kyle, we talked about this a little bit before. Kate discussed it a bit, but the similarity of the young male, 18, 20-year-old, who has a mental break or is wrapped up in some kind of social dysfunction that sets him off. You know, we've seen time and time again, these are the killers in these mass shooting episodes. We've seen it in Sandy Hook. We've seen it in Tucson. We saw it at Virginia Tech. We've seen it recently in Buffalo, although that had a particular racial motivation. Uvalde seems to be a case of a man just having some kind of crazy, evil desire to kill. I think starting with his grandmother, he had threatened others, according to accounts of friends, talked about potentially using a gun to kill people. So he just seemed intent on killing. We're still waiting more about the motive. But it does raise the question of whether or not young men of that age, I'm not a psychologist or a psychiatrist, but that's the age time and again where we see young people who don't always become killers by any stretch, but young people have psychotic breaks, schizophrenic breaks, the onset of mental illness. And that's when it manifests itself in many young people. I know of individual cases myself where that has happened, many more than one. And that raises the question of whether or not we should have a law that says, you know what, you can't buy these weapons until you're 21.
Yeah, there are good arguments for that kind of a law. I wonder how it would stand up constitutionally. I mean, of course, we all have the 21 drinking age. On the other hand, the drinking age is not mentioned in the U.S. Constitution. But weighing on the other side of it is the scores and scores of cases, Paul, that you cite where this is happening, and the profile of the mass shooter looks remarkably similar. And so maybe there's some room for some states to experiment with raising the age or even with working on more effective versions of these red flag laws that some states have started to implement that are a relatively recent phenomenon. And maybe we'll learn more in this Texas case about the warning signs that were missed. But in the Buffalo shooter's case, so here's one of the things he did in the waning days of his senior year at the high school. This is reading from an Associated Press story. He logged on to a virtual learning program, an econ class, that asked, "What do you plan to do when you retire?" And he typed murder, suicide. And because of that, the state police visited him. He was taken in for a mental health evaluation. There's also some diary entries that are being attributed to him now. One of them describes how he decapitated a feral cat that was wandering around and apparently told his mom about it. His mom gave him a box to bury the cat in. And so those are warning signs that maybe if we had a more effective red flag law in New York, that could have been raised in a way that would have stopped him from buying the firearms that he used in his shooting.
But it did have a red flag law. New York does have a red flag law. And he was flagged in the sense that his behavior, his comments were flagged, and he was referred for mental counseling, and the police were alerted, and yet nothing happened. I support red flag laws. I know some people who support gun rights do not, because they think it can be used too easily to restrict gun rights. We've got to think about doing something, and that is addresses this issue of disturbed young men and their access to weapons. So I'm in favor of them, but they're not any panacea by any stretch, Kate.
No, they're not a panacea. I do think that some of the concerns that Americans have about due process and stuff can be managed, and there are better ways to write red flag laws, including criminal penalties for false accusations and such. So I do think that they can be useful, but I think what you're getting at is that this is a multifaceted and deeply vexing problem. I do think perhaps some of the red flag laws could also be expanded in some ways to make it easier for parents to talk to somebody about problems they're having with their kids without triggering this legal process. It can be very bureaucratic to file one of these requests. I think you need to make it as easy as possible for people who are worried about a loved one to come to the authorities and get that process started. So I think that would be one thing to potentially look at in making the laws more effective. But I do think it will not end the problem. And we have also seen even recently the terrible parade massacre where somebody drove an SUV into a parade of dancing grandmothers in Wisconsin. We've seen that guns are not the only way people who are ill can inflict violence and damage and terrible damage. So we need to your point, look for these kind of problems developing, and particularly in young men, even outside of merely owning firearms, though that's predictive, of course, or invaluable. It won't end the problem of men resorting to such violence.
All right, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we'll talk about the emerging political debate on guns and mass shootings in the wake of the Uvalde horror when we come back.
U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at AlibabaPowersBusinesses.com.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. I'm Paul Gigot with Kyle Peterson and Kate Batchelder-Odell. So The debate is unfolding here politically in the wake of this massacre in Uvalde, and it's taking, in many ways, predictable turns, with Democrats and the dominant cultural voices in the media and other institutions calling for much more gun control. But their proposals are multiple and often smaller than the rhetoric might suggest, and we want to talk about some of those. But first, let's listen to a couple of clips of Beto O'Rourke challenging the governor of Texas, Greg Abbott, and a variety of officials at a press conference where they were talking to the public about what happened. And then following that, Beto O'Rourke makes a couple of his own comments at a press conference.
Excuse me.
Sit down.
You're out of line and an embarrassment.
Sit down.
Next shooting is right now, and you are doing nothing. No, you need to get his out of here.
This isn't the place to talk this over.
This is totally predictable when you.
Sir, you're out of line. Sir, you are out of line. Please leave this auditorium. I can't believe you're a sick son of a that would come to a deal like this to make a political issue.
The majority of Texas is with us on this right now. The majority of Texas is not reflected by that governor or those people around the table who talk about mental health care or say that this is pure evil or that it was absolutely unpredictable. This is predictable. It will happen and it will continue to happen until we change course.
Beto O'Rourke, of course, the Democratic nominee for governor of Texas against Greg Abbott, who's running for re-election in November, trailing in the polls by something like 7-8 points up to this point, Beto O'Rourke being, of course, the former challenger to Ted Cruz. Senator Ted Cruz lost narrowly in that race, then ran for president. And in that race, he said he was in favor of banning all AR-15 rifles. So I guess Beto thinks that this is a good issue for him, Kyle. He must think that he needed to do this. This was an opportunity for him to grab some attention and drive this issue. And, you know, he has some point on some of the polling. The polling shows that some gun control measures, like more background checks, red flag laws, ban on 18-year-olds buying guns, they have significant public support, although Beto O'Rourke himself has backed away from a total ban on AR-15s, as I recall.
Right. But the problem with those kind of proposals is always that there are something like 400 million firearms that are already in American homes. And that's the other part of this argument that I find really tiresome is these talks about how the gun lobby is holding this issue and preventing anything from happening, because it's not the gun lobby, it's the millions of people who own firearms. They are trying to protect their homes. They are trying to protect themselves from wildlife. If they live in a place where there are bears and moose roaming around, they go hunting. And those are the people who are opposed to a lot of these new restrictions. But just to clarify the point I was trying to make earlier, I grant that New York has a red flag law, but in that case, it did not prevent the Buffalo shooter from getting his weapons. And I think the question that legislators ought to be looking at is why. And as Kate says, this is kind of a bureaucratic process. You can go look up the red flag application in New York and you file it to a court. There's required to be a $210 filing fee. Then you have a fee waiver you can put on that. And if you look at the form, one of the flagged behaviors that you can list, it does not include animal abuse, which is something that unites a lot of these cases. And so I do think there is real room for some of these states to figure out why some of these cases are too low to meet the bar for a red flag law, or why they're not being reported, and then to adjust the bar. There's a balance between due process and saying that someone who made a threat against his school and who, you know, decapitated a cat is not permitted to buy a firearm shortly after he turns 18. And that may be a place where there is some room for compromise in Congress. Rick Scott is saying that he doesn't oppose a red flag law. He's a prominent Republican senator. There are others who are saying they don't oppose it in principle. They just think that it should be done at the state level instead of at the federal level. But maybe there's some room for state legislators to do some adjustment of those laws.
I couldn't agree more that it should be done at the state level. A classic police power law. The thing for me that is so vexing about gun control proposals, Kate, is the disconnect between what is proposed and the likelihood that it would actually prevent any of these mass shootings. I mean, when you think about background checks, for example, we already have background checks, right? The loophole is so-called is that private gun shows. So if Paul Gigot sells Kate a gun, it doesn't show up in the background check, okay? But when I go to a gun store and buy a gun, or if you do, then you have to go for a background check. But Ramos would still have been able to buy the gun. Why? He has no criminal record. He just turned 18. He bought the guns, and that would have been fine. What about a waiting period? 6 days, something like that? Well, he'd get the guns after 6 days. All others of these killers do get their guns illegally, notwithstanding whatever gun control laws exist. And of course, if you are in New York, you were recently horrified by the case of some kind of ill man shooting a Goldman Sachs employee on the subway in midday on Sunday as he went to a brunch. New York has some of the most restrictive gun laws in the nation, and it doesn't stop gun mayhem that happens every single day.
Right, Paul. I mean, I think that's why it's so disappointing that we're just reaching for some of the same ideas here when we don't really have much evidence that they would help prevent what just happened. Background checks, I think, is probably the one getting the most attention. But in this case, to your point, Ramos had just turned 18. There's been some question about his juvenile record and whether law enforcement has access to that. But we don't have any indication yet that a background check would have flagged him and stopped him from purchasing a gun or any of the other measures that you mentioned. So I do think, you know, there's this obvious want to do something to stop this. And any normal person is experiencing that in the aftermath of such an awful attack. But the reach to do something that might be counterproductive or just simply not helpful is not going to be constructive. So I do think it warrants a longer conversation after we've established a fact pattern of what happened here about what it would actually prevent someone in this kind of mental state from getting their hands on a deadly weapon. But we don't seem to be headed for that. We seem to be headed for some show votes in the Senate, some demands for breaking the filibuster, even though Joe Manchin has said, and I think quite sensibly, we should be able to get to 60 votes if there's something that we can do to prevent this. So unfortunately, I think we're headed for kind of a repeat of some of the politics we've seen before where there's not much progress and not much is dislodged on what can actually be done.
Manchin has worked in the past with Pat Toomey, the Republican from Pennsylvania, on some kind of background check expansion. That fell foul of a filibuster in the past. We'll see if it can get 60 votes now. But I have a suspicion, Kyle, that Democrats don't mind if it fails in the Senate, because I think what they're looking for perhaps is to use this as an issue, gun control as an issue in the election, guns and abortion being better issues for the Democrats than inflation and the higher cost of living and the border and the problems overseas.
Yeah, that's possible, although the counterargument to that is, I mean, they'd rather talk about that than inflation and so on, but there are a lot of states that have real rural areas that are up for election. I mean, Arizona, Wisconsin, those are big Senate races. And there are a lot of deer hunters in Wisconsin and people who are opposed to laws tightening these kinds of rules. You know, maybe they've gone to a gun show. There are a lot of people in Wisconsin who maybe have sold one of their personal firearms to their cousin or their neighbor. And they're looking at these bills and saying, I mean, really, you're going to make me to do a background check, some sort of federal background check on my neighbor? That sounds like a real hassle. I know he's a good guy. And so I'm not sure that it will play with them. I mean, it's the usual dynamic lately of the rural, suburban, and urban polarization, where this is an issue that is really motivating for, I think, people, suburban moms, people in urban areas, but there are big swaths of the country where it is the reverse.
This Friday, Kate, the National Rifle Association is holding its convention in Houston. By coincidence, Donald Trump, Ted Cruz, Senator from Texas, and Greg Abbott, the governor, all scheduled to attend. But the NRA much weakened as a force. It had been indicted by the attorney general in New York, and I think that case has kind of petered out. But it has been under attack. It's not nearly as powerful as it was. And as Kyle suggested, the real issue with guns is the individuals who believe in their rights and don't trust political figures to be able to manage gun control without seriously restricting individual rights. And one of the facts that simply is unavoidable, and it's a reality, is every time gun control comes to the fore as a political issue, gun purchases soar. And that's one of the reasons we have so many guns in this country. I mean, literally, women and minorities have been some of the biggest purchasers of guns in the 2 years since the George Floyd murder and the unrest in cities that followed.
Right, Paul. I mean, the lobbying influence of the NRA has been much weakened by successive scandals, and it really is an issue that it's simply that voters have different opinions on it, not an organized lobbying group. So I think that is really the thing that has precluded some of the solutions that the left wants here. I mean, another thing that I'd add that isn't so much a problem as is advertised is we are frequently told that the Second Amendment is really the barrier. And you have Joe Biden saying the Second Amendment is not absolute. Well, no, it's not. And in fact, there's a history of jurisprudence allowing a lot of state regulation on guns. So when you get down to it, we have an issue of political persuasion here, and we have a country that is not similar to Australia in that we are not going to be able to do a large gun buyback program in this country. If we said in our editorial today, if you think America is polarized now, try putting through a policy like that. So the obstacles really here are persuading voters and, to your point, persuading them that politicians can make distinctions here that respect the rights of individuals to own guns without traducing too far. But I don't see much progress on that front, even from an event like this, because I don't think there are any number of solutions in the offing that voters look at and think, well, that would really make a difference.
I need to correct myself. I think I said that the NRA had been indicted by the New York Attorney General. No, it was a civil suit. The lawsuit to dissolve the NRA was not a criminal complaint. So this issue is going to evolve, and we'll see how the politics plays out. I want to thank Kate Batchelder. I want to thank Kyle Peterson, and I want to thank all of you for listening. You can catch us every day now on Potomac Watch on your favorite podcast purveyor. And be sure to send notes to us, complaints. You can send notes about Kate and Kyle, complaints to us at pwpodcast@wsj.com. You already send them to me, so. All right. Thank you all for listening, and we hope to catch you tomorrow on Potomac Watch.
U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at alibabapowersbusinesses.com.